Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Edward France, who is a presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis. He has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last two centuries, and his newest book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, is just out in paperback. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward France.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
And your book, of course, is about the Southern strategy, and it's pretty clear the Republican Party has essentially become a Southern party. In fact, it was pointed out that the map of this last election, the red versus the blue, was almost identical to the map of the United States on the eve of the Civil War. So what do you make of that?
It's striking, isn't it? I mean, it really would, if you could have done time travel, people just really would not have believed the political transformation, the geographical transformation. And, I mean, I think there certainly that was part of the strategy. I don't think anybody could have imagined in the 1870s when the end of Reconstruction really caused the need for this strategy to at least be experimented with, that it could have been so widely successful in the 21st century as far as the Republican Party's base in the South. So it's been dramatic indeed, that's for sure.
But not without consequences. There is a certain amount of fratricide going on within Republican ranks following this last election. One of the people that ran the John McCain's campaign in 2008, Steve Schmidt, who's a commentator on MSNBC, he was on the Sunday talk shows a week or so ago, where he referred to the people that are dominating the current Republican Party as the conservative entertainment complex, referring to the Fox News commentators and Rush Limbaugh. Where do you think this argument is heading?
Well, as you know, historians are always better looking backward rather than forward. But, you know, I think there's one part of me that says let's put the brakes on all of this discussion about the decline of the Republican Party. Because even in my lifetime, I can remember not that long ago when people were wanting to write that same obituary for the Democratic Party, and that was in 2004, right? When you had a Republican reelected to a second term with control of both the House and the Senate. So there's one part of me that says, you know, this is the natural time when a party that loses on the presidential level really tries to figure out how did we get here and what went wrong. And we tend to perhaps overemphasize the extent of the defeat. But I do think it is an interesting moment right now for the Republican Party, and it's a moment in which many of the ideas that have that really resonated and provided goals for a generation or two of politicians, limited government, you know, winnowing down on many of these things, and strong foreign policy, have reached in many ways their culmination as far as their usefulness in the presidential election. At least it looks that way. So basically the Ronald Reagan playbook, to put it another way, looks like it would be hard to use four more years down the road. And so then what you do in its place, what does the Republican Party want to be? That's a question, of course, that's really fascinating to anybody who's observed politics over any length of time.
Again, I'm speaking with Edward France, who is a presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis. He has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last two centuries, and his newest book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy is just out in paperback. Now, in terms of the Reagan legacy, surely the President George W. Bush, if you say that it's been about limiting government and having strong foreign policy, George W. Bush increased government, increased the deficit, and was ruinous in terms of U.S. foreign policy. Is that what's changing the Republican Party?
I think there's an outgrowth of that. And, you know, that's something the argument you just made there in an incredibly short period of time there, Ian, is one that in red state America, Democrats still have trouble pointing out, right? I mean, I think there still is, and that would be reasons why Republicans probably would have hope right now, right, is that the difficult financial situation that has existed over the last 4 years, and that's clearly an understatement, has been pinned successfully in the South and in Indiana and some other red states on the current administration rather than the Bush administration, as you hinted at. And if that's the case, that would suggest they're not quite as dead as some of the pundits might have you believe.
Well, certainly, in terms of the popular vote, there was a 3 million difference. So
yeah,
it's not, nobody can suggest that this was some vast sea change in America where America suddenly turned blue. It certainly did in the Electoral College, but not in the popular vote. So what then do you make, Edward France, of the arguments amongst a lot of Republicans saying, and fairly prominent ones, saying that the party can't afford and cannot sustain itself over the long term if it is hostile to women and minorities?
Well, that's where I think were the party to invest a lot of effort, a lot of time, not just rhetoric, but effort in saying that this party has an incredibly strong history as a leader in expanding rights. You have to go back a ways, and many people alive today don't have memory of that. But if you go back a ways, that is a proud tradition. And I think the Republican Party at its best has been about helping to increase those rights, leading the way, and really being the only ones responsible for getting the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment ratified and becoming law, helping to contribute with key votes in Congress on the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which absolutely had the support and leadership of Lyndon Johnson, but when it came to votes within the Congress, couldn't have been done without Republicans. From time to time, the current Republican Party will mention that, but when they do, it tends to be in a pretty dismissive or half-hearted way, and it has not been effective at all. And so certainly they could connect their future to their past. And for a historian, then that is something we're deeply interested in seeing, that the people who move forward do so on the basis of what has happened before rather than just on dreaming a utopia.
Again, I'm speaking with Edward France, a presidential historian. He teaches at the University of Indianapolis and has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last two centuries. His newest book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, is just out in paperback. Now, you had a ringside seat there in Indianapolis, Indiana, in terms of this last election where a really a kind of icon of Republican moderation, Senator Lugar, who was very much the elder statesman of the United States Senate, he got unceremoniously defeated in the primary by Richard Murdoch, who was less than gracious in his victory. And then he, of course, was way ahead of the Democrat in this fairly red state, Indiana. And then he, of course, expressed his personal beliefs on rape and conception as a result of rape, which obviously backfired. One of the things I found strange about that was, though, that this man was actually telling the truth about what he really believes, you know? He got soundly ridiculed. But in many ways, you know, I prefer a politician like that even though I disagree with what he's saying immensely, to a politician that might appear to be a moderate Republican, or actually might be a moderate Republican, but goes along with the anti-abortion dogma in order to preserve his seat. So how is that going to pan out in terms of true believers versus the more pragmatic and perhaps even cynical politicians?
Well, that's where you always, if you look in the past, the true believers always feel like they've been scorned. Then if they just do things right the next time, they'll really have it work. And of course, many of those true believers then nominated, you know, we're going back to the another time period, nominated Barry Goldwater as their candidate. And if we really just nominated the perfect candidate for the cause of limited government, you know, the ideas would circulate. And that was in response to what they saw as a generation of only moderate Republicans who were not true conservatives. And we saw how that worked out. So within Indiana, I mean, I understand exactly your take on Richard Murdoch was inarticulate. I think for anybody for whom he wasn't on the ballot, it's very easy. So people watching nationally, it's very easy to outsiders for that to look like a farce and to make it into a farce. But, you know, in many ways, that was tragedy unfolding that a person I would argue with you that, you know, he was being honest, and that's credible. But that these ideas that he espoused, which are so far out of the mainstream, could be ones that, you know, a candidate for the United States Senate would hold is pretty striking. And certainly then to Hoosiers who had not warmed up to the idea of a Murdoch representing them in the state, that was all the permission they needed finally to say, all right, this, we can't go from Richard Lugar, as you said, the elder statesman in many ways of the Senate, to Richard Murdoch. Yes, they share the same first name and allegedly the same party, but people just couldn't see that happening. And I guess the last bit that I would add to that is, you know, the candidate he was running against, I think that's a big portion of why Richard Murdoch felt like he had to do what he did, because the Democrat that he was running against, to many liberals, wasn't liberal enough. He's a blue dog Democrat who is pro-life, right? So how do you distinguish yourself? You're even more ardently pro-life, and that probably got him to the position that he was in with that statement.
Well, clearly the defeat of Murdoch and Aiken, and then going back to the previous election, Sharon Angle and the strange witch lady in Delaware, mm-hmm. Has led a lot of the current Republican pundits to basically say, you know, this is why we've got to, you know, clean up our house, because we're losing. We could have won the Senate, but for these extreme candidates. And now you've got Rush Limbaugh getting incredibly defensive and saying, you know, they're trying to blame me for the election loss, you know. And again, in the context of what's been being described as the conservative entertainment complex. It does lead one to question, though, the fact that Limbaugh and Hannity and these characters and Karl Rove, too, have so much influence. It makes you wonder who's running the show. I mean, is this a party without a leadership? Is this a party where talk show hosts and fundraisers have more influence than the nominal head of the party?
At this moment, you know, a week away from Mitt Romney's, to them, devastating defeat. In this moment, yes. Because
can you just say 2 weeks away? Because this is being broadcast next week. Sorry.
Okay. Right. Yeah. So 2 weeks from now, when we still haven't had anybody to emerge. Yes. I mean, I think you see a moment right now where Speaker of the House Boehner certainly hopes that he can position himself to be that voice for the Republican Party, and that perhaps the negotiations over the fiscal cliff can provide an opportunity for some Republicans who fashion themselves as being sane and results-oriented to come together and forge a solution. And out of that predicament, if things go well, then you could see perhaps the reclaiming of the leader, the mantleship of leadership by politicians rather than by their allies in conservative media. But I think right now one of the things that's interesting is that you don't get widespread circulation right now of conservative ideas that are actually ideas where you have intellectuals leading that. For a long time, people made the argument that William F. Buckley and other conservatives really had an agenda, whether you liked it or not, where they were advancing a lot of ideas and conservative ideas and developing think tanks to do that. You don't have somebody who you can take seriously as an intellectual right now advancing arguments that would run counter to Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity. And that's unfortunate. There certainly are those people who are out there, but they don't have the platform, they don't have the visibility, and partially it's because they've also been co-opted by that system and appear as guests on those already established shows where they can separate themselves. And maybe there's an opportunity for those kind of ideological leaders to come together with some of the politicians who lament where they are to forge some sort of new coalition for the Republican Party moving forward. But it is really hard to imagine the current situation of the Republican Party resulting in a strong candidate 4 years from now, at the moment that we're in here, post-election 2012.
And of course, Edward France, John Boehner is looking over his shoulder at Eric Cantor, who is clearly very ambitious and is out for his job. So we have to hold our breath in that regard.
Yeah, and we'll see. I think probably a three-headed monster vying for leadership, I would imagine, of where you have not only Eric Cantor over one shoulder and Paul Ryan over another. And there are visions of a future party that people have there, and then maybe in the Senate with Marco Rubio, where they like to imagine a knight in shining armor coming in on a white horse to save the day. But you know, there's so many unknowns about what unfolds both in the immediate and then intermediate future that it's really tough to say, well, this is how it's going to go. But I certainly do hope that what people are realizing is, I think if you look at the Tea Party as a populist movement, and I think it, at its roots it was, those over the course of American history also have ebbed and flowed, right? And the Republican Party a century ago responded to populists who in parts of the country thought that the Republican Party was the enemy. And that was, you know, in the 1890s and when populism spread. So I find it you know, populism often yields dramatic short-term results, but it's hard to channel that into something meaningful. And then you either, as you said, have the true believers who want to remain pure, or the good portion of it, a lot of the energy, enthusiasm, can get co-opted by the larger movement. So I find that part, again, instructive how our past can inform our present, perhaps our future.
Well, Edward France, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Edward France, who is a presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis. He has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last two centuries, and his newest book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents in the First Southern Strategy, is just out in paperback. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the influx of women into the new Congress and whether the presidential glass ceiling will soon be broken.
So there's a band in that track, and the father's fighting it.